are very excited to have Alice Skady with us for the second half of this show. Alice was recently promoted to Associate Professor in Linguistics at Monash University. She works, among many other great things, on the language of space and time in Kuktaior, a language of Queensland, North Queensland. And we're very excited to have her. Please, a round of applause for Alice.
So, Alice, you work on things to do with space and time in different languages. What do you mean when you work on space and time?
Well, space not as in rockets and stars and moons.
I'm very disappointed already.
Though, of course, always open to possibilities. If anyone wants to give me a grant to explore it, I will be glad
to. We have an Australian Space Agency now.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah.
That's right, they need me.
Maybe if they, you know, maybe if the aliens arrive, they'll call you up.
Yes, that's right, the real arrival. But this kind of space I look at is how people talk about relationships between objects in physical space around us. So our glasses of water arranged on the table, the way people are sitting in this lovely theatre.
So we might use words like, you are both to my left. I know some people are stronger on left and right than others, and that's fine. So we might talk about lefts and rights, but what other ways of talking about such relationships can we have?
Right, well, of course, the problem with left and right is, from our perspective, sitting up here on the stage, Gretchen and I are to your left, Lauren, but from the audience's perspective, we're to the right of you, which can get a little bit tricky when you're trying to do this mental rotation all the time. In other places around the world, people rely more on systems that are more objective, that don't rely on a particular viewpoint. So saying that we are to the perhaps south.
Let's quiz everyone. Let's see how we go. So we kind of do this with north and south and east and west. Just to kind of see how everyone's internal compass is going. And you are in the CBD grid, so, like, if anyone's going to get it right, it's Melburnians right now. Should we get everyone to point north?
Oh, this is a surprising amount of consensus, except for one person.
I told you, Gretchen, that they're good. Melburnians are good. That is north.
I would not have known.
Round of applause for yourself if you pointed north. Yeah, great. Excellent. We had lots of north-pointing people, but if you stick a bunch of English speakers anywhere, it's kind of pretty much close to chance whether they get this right.
Well, even worse than chance.
Worse than chance.
Oh, no.
That's impressive.
My other student, Tom Poulton, actually did exactly this. He had a bunch of English-speaking students, native English speakers, Monash University. They came into a room and he asked them, that wasn't actually pointing, but it was giving them a little, you know, toy block and saying, can you put this block to the north of this other block? And to make things especially easy for them, they were located in a building that has a north wing, a south wing, a west wing, and an east wing.
No.
So to even find their way to the room, they had to have some idea of which direction was which. And yet over 90% of them put it in the wrong place, sort of within 45 degrees of accuracy. So this is not something English speakers are very good at.
Apparently not.
No.
What about Kuktaior speakers?
Yeah, so it is something that Kuktaior speakers are incredibly good at. And, you know, this often gets hooked into this, what is often referred to as the Whorfian idea, that the language you speak shapes the way you think about the world. And it's not quite as simple as that, because, of course, English speakers have words for north, south, east and west. So it's not about the linguistic resources, what the language.
And if you put them in an environment like the Central Business District of Melbourne, which is on a north-south grid where everyone knows which one is north and south, you can actually get an audience that performs much better than 90% off. gets about 80% correct, I would say, from looking out at you.
Yeah.
I find this really interesting because a number of cities, so I always navigate by where the water is because I grew up on the east coast of Canada with the water. And when my mom comes to visit me in Montreal, she says, which way's north? What she actually means is, where's the water? And so I'm like, the river is that way. And she's like, okay, we're okay. but Montreal has shifted its entire city grid system off by about 45 degrees. So what people call north in Montreal is not magnetic north, because the river runs on this 45 degree angle. And so south is towards the river, north is towards the mountain. And that's all shifted because the streets are on a like northeast, southeast, northwest, southwest grid. People treat those as if they're real north and real south. And when I started looking into this more, other cities have their kind of local geographies that have various skews for like north or south.
As any good Melburnian knows, the HODL grid is off by 15 degrees. So I hope you all took that into account when you were pointing north.
So there may have been consensus, but not for actually polar north.
Yeah, cultural north.
Yeah, and that's, you know, incredibly common around the world, that these words that we translate as north, south, east and west very, very rarely align with polar north and so on. But they do tend to align with local salient landmarks. So in Pomparao, where Kuktaur is spoken, the direction that I would translate as north isn't polar north, it's north along the coastline of that area, which again is skewed a little towards the east.
And speaking of coastlines, you had a project with some researchers that were looking at the delightful realities of living on atolls.
I was so jealous of the students in that project who did all this fieldwork in these wonderful atoll locations in the Maldives, in the Marshall Islands. It was just absolutely spectacular.
Can we refresh my memory about what an atoll is?
It's a lovely sandy. I've seen a few presentations of this research, and they have the best PowerPoint slides because it all is just like wonderful beaches.
Yeah. So these lovely sandy beachy islands.
Beachy islands, and crucially, they're arranged in this sort of donut shape. So it's a ring of islands arranged around a sort of central lagoon. So there's this beautiful, very calm lagoon in the middle and then ocean all around the outside.
This sounds lovely. I would like to be one of your students.
They don't all get to go to atolls, unfortunately.
And what kind of talking about space happens there?
Yeah, so one of the motivations for this project was to look at the extent to which the physical topography people are embedded within predicts the forms used in the language. So we knew that in some atoll environments, people used a lot of words meaning lagoonward, oceanward, which of course changes direction. Lagoonward is going to be to the north if you're at the south point of the sort of ring of islands, but it's going to be to the south if you're at the north. So we have these lagoonward, oceanward axes.
Do they do kind of clockwise and counterclockwise as
exactly, well? Exactly, yeah. So we knew that that happened in some locations, but of course most atolls are located in the Pacific and are populated by speakers of a single language family, the Austronesian language family. So when you see these sort of recurring similarities, you don't know whether that's something that's just inherited through related languages or something that's developing organically because of that particular environment. So we went to, well, I didn't go to, but my student went to the beautiful Maldives just off the coast of India, where an entirely unrelated Indo-European language is spoken, Divehi, to see what they did there.
And was it something similar?
Similar-ish. So there are some terms that exploit this lagoonward, oceanward kind of axis, but it doesn't look quite like the way they do it in the Marshall Islands and elsewhere.
Right. Like
I was
any
in
good
Hawaii
research.
A year ago, and they have words for seaward and mountain word, or like volcano word. So they're not an atoll, they're individual islands, but they're the inward-outward words. And of course, that's also an Austronesian language, are within an individual island. Are you going towards the sea or going towards the mountain? And we were in a building at the university, and the wings of the building were labeled like with the word for ocean and the word for mountain, which is very neat.
So that's the physical space. But then when it comes to talking about time, which we can touch space, but we can't really touch time. It's very abstract and it's hard to get our brains around. We end up co-opting a lot of how we talk about space to talk about time.
Right. As humans tend to do, you know, with anything that is really difficult to wrap our minds around, we exploit metaphors. We get to the, you know, really tangible, familiar domains that we can sort of exploit to talk about these slipperier concepts like time, which, you know, I didn't even realise how difficult it is to understand exactly what time was until I started researching it and needed to come up with a proper definition of time. And something that seems so obvious and that we all experience and talk about all the time, it is actually a very difficult concept.
So English speakers' metaphor for time... We have the future is in front of us, the past is behind us.
Looking forward to seeing you next Tuesday. And last Christmas, I gave you my heart.
The very next day, you gave it away. But other languages don't necessarily do this.
That's right. So, you know, in English, we're oriented, as you say, to look ahead to what's coming up and feel like what's in the past is behind us. But then we have a reversal of that axis for speakers of languages like Aymara, spoken right up at the very north of Chile and bordering countries, where you have the past in front. So in the visual field, it's familiar.
It makes sense because I know what happened in the past. I have some kind of record of it. Whereas I have no idea what's happening tomorrow. It kind of makes sense that tomorrow would be sneaking up behind me.
It makes perfect sense for English speakers, as you say. And yet it's very, very difficult when English speakers say, oh, yeah, of course I can think about the future being... And they can't quite gesture behind them because it just feels weird to think about way back in the future, way back in 2050.
There's these beautiful videos of Aymara speakers. Yeah. And Rafael Nunez and Ev Swetzer did this work where, you know, they talk about, I actually have to think really hard to do this, where they're like... Oh, yeah, a long, long time ago, or they talk about, what's going to happen in the festival next year, and it's really surreal to see that happen.
Hmm. So you can sort of understand the logical basis for it. But
it's really hard to wire yourself into doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And what happens with speakers of Kuktaior who have this north-south situation?
Yes.
Does that come into time as well?
Not in the language.
Right.
And that is something that I was always really curious about because I knew how important this north, south, east, west system was. I mean, it's literally the first thing you say to someone when you see them and you greet them. You say, where are you going? And they'll respond, I'm going a long way north, northeast, or I'm going just a short way to the southwest or whatever it may be.
So this is the kind of how are you, are you going?
Exactly. And so you're constantly paying attention to these directions because you need to keep oriented so you can just say hi, basically. So I knew that this was communicatively central and for that reason I'd sort of expect time metaphors to be popping up there but just don't see them in the language. And yet... when you include gesture as part of this repertoire that people are drawing on to communicate with one another, started to look to me like people were gesturing to the east when they were talking about the olden days.
Oh. Right. Could we think of a reason why that might be?
Sun rises in the east.
Mm. Sounds like a good hypothesis to me.
It's a good hypothesis, but with a confounding factor. So the sun rises to the east, but also the Pormpuraaw, where the language is spoken, is a sort of modern place where everyone lives. But traditionally, people were much more scattered, and many of these homelands were to the east.
Ah, okay.
Right. So there's also an association with the, distant
the whole
past
land.
To the
go.
East and a lot of these old stories, whereas collecting these gestures were about times where people were further to the east. So that's why we set out to also gather some experimental evidence, getting people to just talk about things like yesterday, tomorrow, arranging cards, showing events unfolding over time, like a little chicken egg cracking slowly and then another photo with the chicken's head popping out, and then another photo with the chicken completely out of the egg, and you ask them, can you lay these out from start to finish to show what order they happen in? And we found people tended to lay them out from east to west, whether that was from their left to right or from their right to left or from away from them, closer towards them, or the other way. So
this metaphor is really wired into people's way of thinking about time, even if they don't speak about it, which we might think is weird until you start thinking about how Alice was gesturing about yesterday and tomorrow, or the baby, the egg turning into the baby chicken, and all of your gestures were from the left to the right. But we don't have any spoken metaphors that say, rightward Christmas, I gave you my heart, but the very left day you gave it away. We don't.
I think we should record this hit song.
I just have no idea why that. But for us, the reason is the writing system. So
exactly.
And so if you ask speakers of Hebrew or Arabic or something that have the writing system going the other direction, they should lay out pictures in the other order.
Exactly.
That probably.
Yeah.
And
indeed, we've done this.
And they do. They've done this. Okay,
yes.
Good. I was just guessing. This is the hypothesis based on prior knowledge. Yeah.
Thank you for letting us pick your brain about space and time and language and gesture. What a big surprise. I found someone else who likes talking about gesture. Since we have Gretchen all the way here from Canada, we thought we'd finish tonight by playing a bit of a game. There's a fabulous new game show called Can Gretchen Figure Out What These Australian Words Mean? yes.
Hey, welcome. Ask the Canadian.
So because I have the home ground advantage, I get to go first, and I've just brought another linguist with me.
This is highly unfair, and I object to all of it.
I've also just brought an entire audience of Australian English speakers, so we're ganging up on you entirely. Alice has chosen three Australianisms to test you on. I've got them here for you, and I've got some extra facts that I might bring up if they're pertinent. You can choose which one you choose her on first.
So am I going to try guess?
And you're going to try and guess.
All right.
What is a witch's hat?
A witch's hat.
Other than
the hat
worn
that
by
a witch. Maids wears.
Correct,
the pointy one.
But also not the one we're looking for.
I did bring some Canadian Halloween candy for, we're not doing the Halloween theme. Okay, a witch's hat. So it's probably a spatial metaphor for something that's kind of shaped like a witch's hat. Maybe? I don't know. You guys don't seem very optimistic about this.
Let's see where you're going with this.
So what kinds of things are shaped like a witch's hat? I'm thinking maybe some sort of like cover that you put on something, or like a, traffic cone or something.
Whoa.
Like.
Whoa.
She got it right.
What?
I had no idea. That's really clever. Okay.
Yes. Apparently, in other countries where they call them traffic cones, Australians are all apparently 5-year-olds. We all call them traffic cones.
Yeah, traffic cones. Or it's funny because the ones in Montreal have a very distinct cylindrical shape, and they're not actually pointy on top. But the ones in other provinces are pointy. There you go.
Alice, you told me you picked this one because you used to live in the US.
I did, and I was laughed at mercilessly. So I hope that this was my chance to get revenge, but you did very well. Disappointingly.
I'm sorry. It helps that there was a lot of construction outside the State Library on the way in. So have you ever been to Canada?
I have, okay. Yes, but I didn't get to spend as much time there as I would have liked to. It was so beautiful.
Do we have another one?
We do.
Yeah, let's get all of your embarrassment out of the way. What does it mean to chuck a yui?
Chuck a yui.
Which can only be pronounced as chuck a yui.
Chuck a yui. So is that like to pull a U-turn? Let me just say, I'm doing much better than I was in Sydney last week.
For someone who claims to not drive an automobile, she's doing very well. So I did a bit of research on yui. Obviously, is a U-turn, but why say U-turn when you can make it more informal? Chuck, as a very English verb, has been around since the 1940s, so we can maybe test you on some other ones. Chuck a sickie.
Oh, I've heard this one. It's like to have a sick day or like pull a sick day.
Yep. Chuck a wobbly.
I have no idea.
Okay, wait, let me try to reason this out since it works so well for Witch's Hat. Okay. What are some things that are wobbly? So is this like, do you have some, I'm getting some sort of like vehicle, some sort of automobile, some sort of thing, like you're wobbling around.
I'll give you a clue.
Okay.
It's synonymous with chuck a tanty.
Is that to have a tantrum?
Yeah.
Oh.
The Australian National Dictionary has the first attested chuck a anything is from the 1940s, and it was chuck a willy, which means to get angry.
Oh.
Which is obviously, as you can tell from people's complete confusion, not one that we use today.
I confess, I would have guessed something very different.
All right, I'm worried this one is not difficult enough for you because you're doing too well at this. So.
I have spent a whole week here, so maybe I'm learning.
I'm going to add some extra requirements.
Oh boy, okay.
I want you to give us as many synonyms, and particularly Aussie synonyms for this word as you can.
Okay.
Bathers.
So this one, I have to say, I need to give a shout out to the Linguistics Roadshow, which is a couple of linguists who, some of whom are in the audience, aren't they? There they are. So there are a couple of linguists who go around and take their linguistics program around to various schools all around Australia, and they do various linguistics activities with high school kids, or whatever you call them here, secondary school kids. And they're really cool. And they have an activity where they ask people what they call this. So I have definitely cheated on this one because I know this one has regional differences. So bathers is like what I'd call a swimsuit or a swimming suit. And I know there were other words for them. Cozy?
Yeah.
Yeah? Cozzies?
It's almost a disappointment that we don't have that Family Feud style. Survey says.
There was another one too, and I don't remember what it was. I think Cozzies all you're going to get out of me.
That's okay. That's pretty good. So bathers is the Victorian variant. So no disagreement between Alice and me there, thank goodness. But if you are from Queensland, you may call them. Any Queenslanders in the audience? Togs.
Togs. Okay, I did see
that. And if you're from New South Wales, you may prefer. We also have quite a few people who refer to it as a cozzy.
But what did the other people say? From
togs.
Togs and the
swimmers.
Swimmers. Okay.
Yeah.
But do Canadians actually swim in suits?
No, no, no. It's not like my swim tuxedo. I mean, it's a suit in the sense that like any set of clothing can be a suit, especially because it's the only garment you wear. And so it constitutes the entire suit of clothing that you wear. It's not a swim tuxedo. But that being said, I have come prepared with my revenge, which are a few Canadians for the delectation of my revenge against this, you know, incredibly large crowd, and these are my two fellow stage members. So I'm going to see if you know what some of these are. So we'll start with one that's particularly common in Quebec, in Montreal. So this is a French term, but English speakers also use it. And this is cinq à sept.
Cinq à sept. I don't speak French.
Five to seven.
But there are some French speakers in the audience who are laughing hysterically.
So I can do, if it helps, I can give you a translation. It won't help that much.
Okay.
So the translation for this is 7 to 5. Or sorry, 5 to 7.
5 to 7.
5 to 7. If anybody learned French numbers and kind of stopped there.
That's my bedtime.
This is why we get along so well doing an international podcast, because we have very different bedtimes.
Could it be something about weekdays and the full week? I'm trying to think of things
that there are seven
fives
of.
Fives and sevens.
This is great. Yeah, definitely keep going with this logic.
Five to seven. That's a really good score in soccer, but a really bad score in football.
Yeah, no, you're getting colder.
Excellent.
That's not good just because it's from Canada.
Is it... Gosh, I have, it's like trying to think about like it's the bottom part of a clock.
They're getting warmer?
Oh, yeah.
Is it like a way of saying like pre-dinner drinks?
Hey, you got it. So this is the Quebec term for a happy hour. Is a cinquassette. And so you might say, oh yeah, we're going to have a cinquassette tomorrow when, you know, after the talk or after work, people go, or a bar might say like, here are our cinquassette prices, or discounts or something
so
like that.
So punctual. I love it.
And then you have dinner afterwards when Lauren's already asleep.
Yeah, I'm asleep. No, I'll just come for the drinks.
Cause I eat dinner very late. Okay. All right. Let's try, another one. Let's try, let's try it. Toonie. You've both been to Canada before.
It's not a cartoon.
No, it's not a cartoon.
Is it tune as in what we would call tune?
No, I think or everyone tune? Would pronounce it toonie, not tuny. Spelled T-O-O.
T-O-O and not cartoon.
Mm. It's not a person who tunes pianos.
This is tricky.
It is tricky. Someone said it's a coin. So I'm going to guess, is it a coin?
Congratulations, audience member who's not Lauren. it's a coin. Which coin might it be?
A two coin?
To what?
Canadian dollars?
We don't have a 2-cent coin, so yes, it's a Canadian $2 coin. And it's so named because our $1 coin, which was introduced in the 80s, has a loon on it. And
what's a loon?
It's a bird, a Canadian bird. It makes this kind of ooh, ooh sound. It's definitely not a very good imitation of a loon. So the $1 coin has a loon on it, and they tried various names to make them catch on, but the one that did catch on was loony. So the $1 coin has the loon, and it's called a loony. And then they tried various names to get for the $2 coin, which they introduced in the late 90s. And the one that caught on, well, if one of them is a loony, two of them must be a toonie.
Flawless logic. This explains why earlier today Gretchen was asking me if we had nicknames for our coins. And I was like, why? Like, that is the most random question you've had for me since you arrived here. Why would we nickname our coin?
We do have nicknames for our notes, though.
True.
Oh, what do you call the notes? We don't have nicknames for ours.
We've got pineapples, which are the yellow notes. You see, okay. Always love you don't to have a, the colours.
Always love to get a pineapple.
Ours are
for
coloured.
Christmas.
Yeah. So I was actually comparing this with Lauren the other day. So our fives and tens swap colours. So our fives are blue and our tens are purple, but your fives are purple and your tens are blue.
You're upside down.
And then the 20s and 50s, our 20s are green and our 50s are red, and your 20s are red and your 50s are green. Yeah.
So the 50s are pineapples because they're that lovely greeny yellow.
20s are lobsters in the red.
All right. Yeah. All right.
But do we have, maybe it's just the pineapples and the lobsters. I think so.
I would go to this buffet.
An avocado.
That's okay. Very Australian.
I can't afford that.
Do you have abbreviations of all of them? Like, do you have like a Lobo and a Pino or something?
Not yet. Surely it's everything only a matter
Gretchen
of time.
Gretchen trying to abbreviate everything is hilarious.
They're officially known as hypocorisms, but I prefer to call them hypocoros because like...
Okay, and what's your
final one? The final one is, what is a keener?
Someone who's more keen?
I've definitely heard this one.
Yes,
and I have no idea.
But in what context?
Yeah. Well, what kinds of Canadian contexts are there? It's not anything to do with lumberjacks. Is it anything to do with maple syrup?
No.
Snow?
No.
Is it like a supporter, someone like cheering
not really,
for their sports
kind of
team?
Not really.
Is it a sports term? Because I'm going to be in trouble with that.
No sports terms.
Okay.
So this one often comes up in academic contexts. And the keeners are kind of the most keen and the most excited students. And what I really like about it is that other varieties of English have terms for, you know, kind of like a brown noser or something like this for academically keen students, but they're all kind of derogatory. Right. And keener is positive.
Oh, I like it.
And so, like, when I talk to other, like, linguists who actually teach these days, they're like, oh, yeah, so-and-so, you know, they're one of my keeners. Like, they always come by office hours, and, like, they always want to chat with me after class. And I thought it was a good word because I know we had a bunch of keeners who were here very early, you know, waiting outside the doors, saying, like, oh, we need to get into this. And I think more people should be celebrating being keen about stuff.
Well, maybe we'll borrow that Canadianism.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's make it happen.
A round of applause to Alice for surviving Gretchen's quiz. And a round of applause for yourselves for also doing so fabulously on it. Thank you, Alice, so much for coming and having a chat with us today.
For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I tweet and blog as Superlinguo.
I can be found as @GretchenAMcSee on Twitter. My blog is allthingslinguistic.com. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gaughan. Our audio producer is Claire Gaughan, our managing editor is Emily Greff, and our production editor is Sarah Dobbiarella. And our music is by The Triangles.
Thanks so much for being a patron.
Stay Lingthusiastic!